Okay, we're continuing with our series on ethics and morality and halakha. And this time we're going to cover the topic of a few different topics, a little bit scattered, but Amalek as the kind of the heading of the shiur, but also having to do with war and genocide, as long as we're talking about Amalek, really. And we're going to focus on Amalek as the springboard for possibly other topics. So first we'll look at the psukim. So we'll start actually with, the main instance where it was actually enacted. In other words, the mitzvah of destroying Amalek. Of course, by the way, this is all in Yanni Dioma, given that we are in the week of Purim and we just read Parshas Zachor. And in fact, this is from the Haftorah of what we just read this past Shabbos. Shmuel Aleph Perek Tet Vav. Thus said the Lord of hosts, right? Hashem Tzvakot, I am exacting the penalty for what Amalek did to Israel for the assault he made upon them on the road on their way up from Egypt. Now go attack Amalek and prescribe all that belongs to him. Spare no one. Prescribe, of course, means cherem. Spare no one. Kill alike men and women, infant and sucklings, oxen and sheep, camels and donkeys. Everybody and everything. Men, women, children, babies, everything, all the animals, they all have got to go. Why? Because of the way that Amalek attacked us on the way out of Egypt. This is explicit in the Psukim in Shmuel. This is how Hashem gives the command to Shmuel to give to Shaul to destroy the nation of Amalek. Now that we have a king, standard understanding is that there were a few mitzvot that we had to do when we got into Eretz Israel, in no particular order, I guess, maybe a particular order, and depending, there's not exactly clear at what point we were supposed to do them, but to appoint the king, to destroy Amalek, and to build the Beit HaMikdash. So here, we have a king, so now we're going to destroy Amalek. Now, of course, this is not, something new that was being introduced to Shaul. This existed beforehand. We have two places in the Torah where the mitzvah of Machiat Amalek seems to be introduced. One is in the original story in Parshat Beshalach, at the end of Parshat Beshalach. The Lord said to Moses, inscribe this in a document as a reminder and read it aloud to Joshua. I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Right? So of Zotzba Sefer Zikarono, that you should remember to destroy I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek. Okay? Hashem says, I'm going to blot out the memory. And Moses built an altar, named it Adonai Nisi. And he said, it means hand upon the throat of the Lord, Yad al Keska. The Lord will be at war with Amalek throughout the ages. Now, to be clear over here from this pasuk, how far can you take this pasuk? What does it mean? Just this pasuk? But what is it? What's going to happen, and who has to do something?
Hashem.
Hashem is going to do it.
It's out of my hands. Hashem is going to take care of it. It's
on. Right, and it's pretty clear. But meanwhile, later on, in Sefer Devarim, in Parshas Kitetze, which is what we read yesterday on Shabbos, Parshas Zachor is from Kitetze, not from Beshalach. The big question, halachically, whether or not reading it in Beshalach is enough. Are you Yotze reading it B'Shalach for the sake of Parshas Zachar? I believe we read Parshas B'Shalach, if I'm not mistaken, on Purim, right? We read this Kriya on Purim, Vayavo Amalek. We read Vayavo Amalek on Purim. Question is whether or not that can help you fulfill the mitzvah of Zachor. Usually understood that it can't. Because this is what we read. Remember what Amalek did to you on your journey after you left Egypt. How undeterred by fear of God, he surprised you on the march when you were famished and weary and cut down all the stragglers in your ear. Therefore, when the Lord your God grants you safety from all your enemies around you, here it comes, and the land that the Lord your God is giving you as a hereditary portion, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under the heaven. Do not forget. Now here it's clear that we are ordered to do something. Right? It's us doing something. But once again,
we're commanded to blot out the memory.
To blot out the memory. What does that mean?
That's a zachor, it's not something...
No, it's two separate things, right? There's zachor, which is to remember to do this, and then there is doing it, right? It would seem that there are two things.
What does blot out the memory mean?
That's a good point, Simon. What is it, and what does it mean? It says blot out the memory. That could certainly be taken metaphorically, or it could be taken literally. I mean, literally, it's clear what it means, or at least we think it's clear what it means.
Get rid of. You can disperse the nation without and kill without destroying the name. I mean, I would destroy the name without necessarily.
No, fair enough. That's true.
Men, women, children, donkeys, and sheep.
That's true. So what we're left with in Chumash, we're left with a kind of a vague notion of what it means, Mechiat Amalek. On the one hand, in one place, it's God that's going to take care of everything. And in the other, it's us that will have to take care of something, but we're not exactly sure what. But when you get to Shmuel, what are you going to do? You got to throw up your hands and say, look, this is what the Navi was told to do. He was told to destroy everybody, men, women, children, animal, there's not much room to move.
I might ask, why do we have to wait till Shmuel to get this directive? I mean, we've had two directives in Shmos and Devarim.
Why did we have to wait till Shmuel?
Why do we have to wait all the way till Shmuel?
Why do we have to wait till Shmuel to appoint a king? Like I said before, there are a few mitzvot. Hi, Andrew. There are a few mitzvot that we didn't do right away for whatever reason when we entered Eretz Israel, but we did them afterwards. And Amalek is one of them. And it seems like Amalek was dependent on having a king, perhaps because we didn't have a serious army until then. Yes, we didn't do it right away.
You're going to associate the fiat Amalek with having a king. Is that what we're saying?
I would. Yeah. I would. Yes. It's, it's not absolutely necessary to do so, but I would.
You're going
to
wage war against someone. You need.
You don't necessarily need a king, but it's definitely useful. And I could understand why a Rishon would say that you do need it. Yeah. But I could also understand why they would say that you wouldn't need it.
Okay.
Well, it also comes down to the next source. Okay? The next source, the Sefer HaChinuch, is the most severe of sources and the most broad. Okay? In terms of how far we take the mitzvah of Mechiyat HaMalek. Take a look at what the Sefer HaChinuch says. Sefer HaChinuch, of course, is an unattributed Sefer. We don't know who wrote it. Okay? It's a very popular, it's a well-known Sefer. Everybody knows about the Sefer HaChinuch. It's a book of the mitzvot. It goes according to Parsha. Gives you 613 mitzvot according to the counting of the Rambam. So he's following, he seems to become from the school of the Rambam. But it's not, we don't know for sure who wrote it. There are speculations. It could have been the Ra'ah. Halevi. It's an Aleph. I can't remember. No, the Minchas HaChinuch, we know who wrote it. We know the author. The Sefer HaChinuch, we don't know, but it seems he wrote it for his son. At least stylistically, he writes all over the place, B'ni HaYakar. He seems to be talking to his son. And Sefer HaChinuch kind of gives the connotation that it is. So don't know if that's just a literary device or whether he literally wrote it to his son. But either way, he writes over here, Shenitztavenu limchod zaro shal Amalek ula'abed zichor min ha'olam zachar unikeva gadol v'katan v'al zeh ne'amar timche et zeicher Amalek shebichlal zeicher hu zachar hu hakol. So, Zecher, who I call, sorry. The idea is to get rid of everybody. And he seems clear. Zachar, Nekeva, Gadol, Katan, Ukvar Ta'a, Benikud, Teva, Zu, Gadol, Ador. And he's not talking about Zecher, Zachar, by the way. He says there have been mistakes about how to read the word Zayin, Chaf, Resh, but he's not talking about Zecher, Zachar. V'hu Yoav, Ben Suriah. This is a Gemara that says, Hishir Mehem, Hanakavut, Nekevot. Yoav left over the girls because he thought it said, Timcha et Zachar, Amalek. Because they weren't careful about it. And the Sefer Chinuch says, this is a mitzvah that who is the intended recipient of the mitzvah? The entire tzibur. Those three mitzvot were given to them when they entered Eretz Israel. So far he said it's mutal al tzibur, which means basically it's up to the army to take care of this, right? Meaning as a nation, you have to make sure to destroy the nation of Amalek. But then he ends with this. The Sefer HaChinuch just, maybe this was obvious to everybody, but he just expanded it and said, not only is it mutal on our entire nation, and it is expressed as a war against Amalek, but more than that, each and every single male Jew has an obligation. If he should come upon a person that he could verify was from the nation of Amalek, no matter who it is, has an obligation to kill that individual.
Does this misstander with you, Rabbi?
I'm reading to you the Sefer HaChinuch. The topic is this. Okay. That's the topic. So the Sefer HaChinuch has the most expansive and detailed and deep version of this, which is not only is it a mitzvah to go to war with them, and even to annihilate them in war, but beyond that, even outside the context of war, if you happen to do a DNA test and find out that somebody comes from the nation of Amalek somehow, and he's, you're a doctor, and he's in your office, and you did a DNA test, and you found that he's Amalek, you now have an obligation to take care of him. That's what the Sefer Chinuch, that's how he reads this mitzvah. Meaning, Adla Rama Achi Amok.
Rav Aaron
HaKohen, thank you. That's the Ra'ah. We don't know if that's who the author of the Sefer Chinuch is, well, but that's who the Ra'ah is.
Rav Aaron HaKohen, that they had dispute out also, according to Wikipedia.
Right, okay. The Ra'ah is a known Rishon from the school of the Ramban, but we don't know if he wrote it or not. Okay, that is the Sefer HaChinuch.
When it was written?
I'd say 1200, 1300, 1400s, in that area. It's Rishon. It's a Rishon. The Menachas Chinuch is an Achron.
All
right. Yeah. Sefer HaChinuch was probably written, I don't know, I don't want to guess, but between probably 1200 and 1300, if I had to guess. Good? Everybody comfortable with that? Should we go home?
No,
really comfortable.
Okay.
No, I'm really uncomfortable.
Yes, we're uncomfortable.
Why are you uncomfortable with this, Ivan?
It doesn't seem very Jewish.
It's the most Jewish thing there is. It's one of the mitzvahs in the Torah.
I understand.
Wait. Before we get what do you mean by the word Jewish in that case? I think I know what you mean, but I want you to say it.
I think Jews are meant to be all a goyim, and we're meant to be the light. We're meant to be the example of the way to behave, and then allow the goyim to live in the world and fulfill their tafkid. We fulfill our tafkid. We do good things. We bring the light into the world.
Have you read the Megillah on Purim?
I've read them. But today, I realized that there's a mitzvah. If somebody's going to kill you, you should get up and you should get them first. But like, to kill their donkeys and their wife.
Because of what they did to us.
Presumably. That's the reason.
Presumably.
That's what bothers me, is what they did to us. What they did to us thousands of years ago. So today, we have a mitzvah to go. Anybody who's Armenian can just, like, take. Generally.
I think it probably is. It's probably reflecting that because of what they did to us, they're a nation that would always do something like that to us.
Yeah, I don't. It's
killing Hitler as a baby.
It's still preemptive.
Famous story.
To do it now means to stop them from doing it again.
Right.
Because of what they did, it shows.
Okay.
Maybe that's what it means.
And do we agree that there is such a thing as this?
Strike.
That they themselves are subhuman, somehow evil.
They have a gene.
Innately evil.
It's a difficult thing, but in the same way that we believe about us as Jews, that there are certain special things that Hashem put in our neshama, and there's something fundamentally different about us, then it's not a stretch to think, well, other people have something different about them.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean
might not be good.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean you can't kill them.
That's,
you have a mitzvah midrash.
If you think they're evil,
who's unmolek, you have to kill them.
If what Matthew is describing is that they are evil, then why not?
If you come across Hitler in his early days,
yeah,
and you saw him suspect characteristics that you might think that he might be unmolek, would you kill him?
Yeah, but that's an individual in any case.
Right now we're talking about individuals. Say for Achinuch.
This individual baby.
A baby.
That you've now verified that this is a monarch.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's problematic. It's not relevant.
It doesn't seem Jewish.
Let's imagine it was.
Because the concept of revenge isn't particularly Jewish. We don't relate to it as particularly Jewish. But
this is outside of the borders of revenge.
So, by the way, you just switched tracks. So, there are two ways that I could have seen us going with this. One, you already took, which is that we assume that they are evil innately, and therefore even a baby is worth killing because they will inevitably grow up to become evil. The other track is not to say that and to simply say, no, it's about revenge, and somehow this was okay, that just from a perspective of revenge, they did what they... No, you would, because...
It's a combination of the two. That's really what gets us to...
I don't know if I need a combination of the two. What does it get you?
Is something physical in your gene, in the chromosomes, which goes on from generation to generation, or is it a philosophy? If it's a philosophy, then one can overpower the philosophy with education. Maybe you say you have to... Do you have a
I'm sorry to interrupt. The obviously, it's not a philosophy. It was saying, if we're told already, we kill
them. So
it's something physical about somebody who's born within a Amalek that means that he is so evil that he should not be in this world. Why did Hashem bring him into this world?
It's a good question.
Genetics. So I just learned with my 9-year-old daughter the last few parakim of of Shoftim. Very disturbing. The the 11 tribes basically exterminated Binyamin.
Almost, yeah.
Almost after, you know, basically in every day,
yeah.
Basically.
Is that them, enough?
Yeah. there's like 3 days of fighting, and like yeah. After every day, like B'nai Yisrael, God, go to the Navi, please don't make us do it. Don't make right. Us do it again. And says, no, go, kill them all, kill them again.
And they say, do it again. Those are Jews.
And those are Jews. So so to say that, and yet, but yet the director from Hashem came to kill them. So to say that, and the individuals didn't necessarily do anything. So to say that it's something which is genetic is also...
Right. No, that was, that, you know...
It isn't genetic because the tribe Binyamin wasn't genetically evil. But yet the directive was still, kill them all.
All right, so let's move on now. Let's move on now to some of the proposed solutions before we get to a different option. So, first of all, the good news, okay?
Right.
The good news is the Gemara in Brachos. Andrew, you said before, of course, this is not relevant anymore, right? Why did you say that?
Well, can we prove that anyone belongs to...
Very good. So the Gemara in Brachos is as follows. On that day, Judah, an Ammonite proselyte, came before them in the Beit Midrash. By the way, that day, anybody know what that day is on the Gemara in Brachos, Daf Kaf Chet Amud Aleph? No. It was an important day. It's actually important. We reference it somewhat in the Haggadah of Pesach. Remember when Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, this is, I'm going around about. Remember when Elazar ben Azariah says, Hari ani kiven shivim shana? Why was he kiven shivim shana? What happened? He was made the Nasi.
Right.
Why was he made the Nasi? Because Rabbi Gamliel, no, he didn't pass away. Rabbi Gamliel was ousted. Why was he ousted? Because he got... you're confusing the stories. They're connected. You've conflated two different stories.
Okay.
Rabbi Gamliel has several encounters with Rabbi Yoshua.
He didn't know
Well, that's later on in the story. What, Rabbi Yoshua and Rabbi Gamliel have these feuds where Rabbi Gamliel tries to... Look, the way it looks like is he tries to... exercise his power as Nasi over Rabbi Yoshua to belittle Rabbi Yoshua, because Rabbi Yoshua sometimes argues with him. So in the case that my father referenced is the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah about what day Yom Kippur was, where Rabbi Yoshua thought it was one day, Rabbi Gamliel thought it was another day, and he forced Rabbi Yoshua to show up on the day that Rabbi Yoshua thought was Yom Kippur to actually travel and walk and carry things, and he forced him to do that. The Gemara in Brachos on Kaf Chem and Amarav, there it's a dispute about whether Ma'ariv is Rishut or Chova, whether Arvi is Rishut or Chovah, where Rabbi Gamliel takes one position and Rabbi Yoshua takes the other position, and when Rabbi Gamliel finds out about Rabbi Yoshua's position, he forces Rabbi Yoshua to say it publicly and then basically makes him stand in the corner. Basically what he does to him. And then the people at that point, the rest of the people in the Beit Midrash, have had enough. And they basically kick out Rabbi Gamliel. They say he can't be Nasi anymore. They have to look for a new Nasi. They end up finding Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Now, why do I say all of this? Because on that day when Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was installed, one of the things that he did was he opened up the doors of the Beit Midrash because Rabbi Gamliel had closed them. Rabbi Gamliel didn't want anybody who didn't have Tocho Kevaro, that his inside wasn't like his outside, which is another way of saying that anybody who was less than perfect in terms of his Limud HaTorah and his actions wasn't allowed into the Beit Midrash. It was closed. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah opened the doors, and on that day, tons of people came in. They said they have to replace and add a lot of benches. And on that day was written an entire Masechta. There's a Masechet in Mishnayot called Masechet Ediot, which is literally testimonies, which is basically everybody that came in told over stories of what they had learned or what they had seen their rabbi or their father or their mother do. Basically, all these halachot that they had said. And the Gemara says that it's the best Masechta. Masechet Ediot is the best Masechta because it's everything from that day. They basically just diarized everything that everybody said when they came in that day. So on that day, Judah, Yehuda, an Ammonite proselyte, okay? This is a Ger Ammoni, a Ger from Ammon, came before them in the Beit Midrash and he said to them, am I permitted to enter the assembly? Am I allowed to marry a Jew? I'm a Ger Ammoni. Rabbi Yeshua said to him, you're permitted. Yes, you are. Rabbi Gamliel said to him, what do you mean? Isn't that already laid down? Because he came back. An Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter into the assembly of the Lord. So here, Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Gamliel, again, Rabbi Gamliel was eventually let back in. So Rabbi Gamliel said, what do you mean? Why should he be allowed in? You're not, we say, Amoni is not allowed to go into the Kahal. Rabbi Yeshua replied to him, do Ammon and Moab still reside in their original homes? Sanherib, king of Assyria, long ago went and mixed up all the nations. As it says, I have removed the bounds of the people and have robbed their treasures and have brought them down as mighty as one mighty their inhabitants, and whatever strays from a group is assumed to belong to the larger section of the group. In other words, Sanherib bilbil et ha'umot. Sanherib, when he conquered the world, essentially, he scattered everybody from the nations to different places. So we can, basically, it became a whole big mishkababo, and we don't know where anybody is from. That's what happened to the ten tribes. Said Rabbi Gamliel to him, but has it not been said, but afterward I will bring back the captivity of the children of Ammon, said the Lord, so they've already returned. But yeah, but he said he was going to bring them back. Rabbi Yeshua said, but it's been said, I will turn the captivity of my people to Israel, and they have not yet returned. But he said he would bring us back also, and we haven't returned. For with they have permitted them to enter the congregation, Rabbi Yeshua won the fight, Ammon was allowed back in. Based on this, everybody says, Amalek is the same. If we can't identify Ammon, we can't identify Edom, we can't identify Mitzrayim, we also can't identify Amalek. And so, for all intents and purposes, this mitzvah that the Sefer Chinuch said applies to each and every single Jew versus every single Amaleki, just doesn't apply practically. So that's the good news.
The mitzvah wasn't rescinded, obviously.
No, the mitzvah exists.
There's no way
it doesn't help us with
It's not applicable. It's not relevant, as they say, but it exists. So in other words, philosophically, we haven't been helped, but practically we have. So you don't have to worry about people running around killing Amalekites. On the other hand, it still exists in potential. So what can we do about that? So we'll start with a few different positions over here. Shita 1, I'll call Chazal didn't like it either. This is an article by Rabbi Eugene Korn. He says, due to lack of certain genealogical identification, it became impossible in principle for any Jew to fulfill the mitzvah to exterminate these peoples, as we just saw. This is consistent with other instances of the rabbinic strategy to render some biblical laws inoperative or barely implementable, such as the execution of the rebellious son, capital punishment, and the destruction of an idolatrous city. Right, we actually learned in the Monday night share, we learned almost all of Ben Sora Mora, and one of the things that we noticed was that Chazal basically darshaned the whole mitzvah out of existence. Now, we believe that that's based on Torah Sheva'al Peh. I personally believe that what Chazal were saying was the original intent. Anytime they said it was Daraisa, it was the original intended meaning. But you still get the impression when you're learning it that, you know, they're going out of their way to show you that this is, don't try this at home, because it can't be tried at home. To the extent that, of course, in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, two out of the three examples that he mentions over here, according to one Amora, never actually happened and never will happen. The Ben Sora Amora and the Irani Da'achat, yes. And the Irani Da'achat, the third one is the Bayit HaMenuga, which I guess doesn't offend people as much. Bayit HaMenuga is when Tzara'at happens to your house, as opposed to just your clothes and your body. And then the house has to be destroyed. So apparently it never happened, and nobody won the jackpot that you get if you knock down your house. That's the bad news, right? Because there's a jackpot.
Yeah, that's the
and the Midrash says that if you have a bayit menuga and you destroy it, then there's going to be gold buried underneath the house. But nobody ever got the jackpot.
These three examples, in Edachas.
The ones that he gives.
Yeah.
He gives the
capital punishment. Well, right. All three.
He's claiming
of things that to us we would call like barbarians. Like you're not going to go in.
That's what he said. He said that they are. Well, he didn't use the word barbaric, but he said these are things that the Chazal. So far, all he said is that they rendered them inoperative or barely implementable. But, you know, if you look at them as the examples of Ben Sora Mora, the boy has to be between the age of 13 and 13 and a half. And he has to have, you know, expensive meat, but not too expensive, and expensive, but not too expensive.
Right.
And he has to eat it in his house, but from his, you know, all these things. Capital punishment, you have to have Eidos, you have to have Hatra'a. They do Drisha V'Chakira on the Eidim and everything. The destruction of the idolatrous city is also very unlikely, apparently. No reason particularly given for why it's going to be unlikely. Or there was the thing with the mezuzah, but that's not really. It just seems unlikely.
It's almost impossible to actually carry out.
Right. There was another rabbinic tradition that all fulfillment of the command to kill the Amalekites is deferred until the Messianic era. So that's something else. That's he's saying that there is a tradition, probably in the Zohar, that it will happen eventually, but not right now. So you don't have to worry about it until later. The effect of these interpretations is to render the mitzvot inoperative and thus avoid any immoral behavior that would result from acting in accordance with their literal meaning. There's no reason to believe that Rabbi Yoshua invented a historical fiction, since it was the actual practice of ancient conquerors to intermingle their conquered peoples to lessen the possibility of organized rebellion. He's referring to Sancheriv. What is remarkable is the legal power that the Talmudic tradition gave to this brute historical fact. In other words, Rabbi Yoshua, he's not lying about what Sancheriv did, but he didn't have to use it in this way. In theory,
could have done the opposite and said, if there's a bit of collateral damage and you get some of the wrong people as well, that's okay because it's such an imperative to
maybe
.
To understand, so he gives an example from real life, to understand the unusual nature of the Talmudic ruling, consider the following scenario. The Israeli army is marching through the Sinai desert led by, this is a great example, and it's basically right up Matthew's alley. Marching through the Sinai desert led by General Yigal Yadin, who's also an accomplished archaeologist. During encampment, Yadin discovers documents buried in the sand that indicate that a clan living in the area is unmistakably descended from the biblical Canaanites. Yadin takes the Canaanim, of course, as well. We were supposed to conquer and destroy them all. The Canaanim, the real Canaanim. Yadin takes the document to the world's leading historians and anthropologists, who will unanimously conclude that the documents are authentic and accurate. In other words, all scientific opinion corroborates the claim that these specific persons are Canaanite descendants. Are religious Jews obligated to act on the basis of the overwhelming empirical data and kill these Canaanites? So let's, I could see, a bunch of Jews who are very serious about their mitzvot, the kinds of people that will search out birds' nests, sedushu lachaken, that will, I'm not putting this on anybody, but the kinds of people who will put on several different kinds of tzitzit, or will find several different kinds of etrogim, and will buy everything on the market, and will try their best to, run after mitzvot, which is great. I could see someone like that saying, no, you hear what they found in the desert? Let's get over there, right? I mean, in theory, that could happen. But he says probably not. For Rabbi Yoshua's Talmudic principle would trump the scientific evidence and the genocidal commandment would remain inapplicable. According to Rabbi Yoshua, you would throw out all of this because of Rabbi Yoshua's din. Even though, in theory, what he's suggesting is that even against evidence, Rabbi Yoshua's rule would apply. But that's an assumption. Maybe Rabbi Yoshua wouldn't say that. We don't know. He's assuming that Rabbi Yoshua's motivation is to get rid of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Right? When it could be Rabbi Yoshua's just being honest, and he thinks this really applies.
He said that at the beginning.
If his motivation is to get rid of the whole thing, then yeah, he'll ignore the evidence.
The rabbinic strategy, didn't
he'll ignore the evidence. Mm-hmm. It's an assumption. This means that the principle functions neither as a historical observation nor an empirical claim, but as a non-falsifiable legal rule. He's assumed that, right? He made that up. Rabbi Yoshua didn't say that. He's reading that into Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yoshua might say in this case, no, if you have evidence that it really is them, then you should do it, Rabbi Yoshua might say. A permanent principle with legal force to override the fulfillment of divine commandment is rare in Jewish legal tradition. It is plausible to assume that rabbinic authorities elevated this opinion to a categorical definitional principle precisely because they sensed the overwhelming moral problems with the literal implement of the commandment. Chazal were not philosophers, but teachers whose ultimate concern was promoting correct action in accordance with how they understood sacred Torah texts. Okay, now he could be making the opinion, he could be taking the position like Simon. It's not a very Jewish thing. Maybe it made sense at the time, but it doesn't make sense anymore, so we gotta adjust it. This is a very dangerous position, though. We have to be very careful with this. He could say that Rabbi Yoshua did this and that he had basis to do it, and maybe if you don't have basis, then you can't do it, but it's still a somewhat of a radical notion.
The principle that the Torah is forever is based on the fact that we have a Sanhedrin that is able to adjust over the time. The problem that we don't have the Sanhedrin today, it means that we are in a Hester, it's called Five Hester.
Right.
It doesn't mean that the Torah was not supposed to adapt over time. Which means that it's quite possible that today we should have lots of other things that we don't have, just because we don't have a Sanhedrin, we haven't adjusted.
The job of the Sanhedrin according to, I assume, most authorities, the job of the Sanhedrin is not to adjust the Torah, but to interpret it.
Okay, but here we see have an example of an Inidachas Ben Saremera that they didn't enable these mitzvahs to take place because it was no longer relevant in their day.
So
I'm saying that
no, not because it was no longer relevant. His claim is that Ben Saremera was darshaned out of existence because Chazal were uncomfortable with it.
Hold on, Chazal were who? Or what period are we talking about? Chazal,
Gemara, it's in Mishnah, Mishnah Gemara, Sanhedrin, everything.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
The whole thing.
So we're talking about that period. Right. They were able to take something which is categorically written in the Torah,
right,
as a mitzvah, say,
right,
say we're phasing this out
based on creative readings, creative readings of the Torah. That's his claim. That's his claim.
Rabbi Shammai, yes. They can also change things because they think that it's not appropriate to them.
I assume that he's saying. The furthest he would say is not to base it in time, but to use their moral intuition, which they assume is objective, which you know certainly people in the 21st century would argue with, mm-hmm, about whether it was really objective or not, whether anybody could be objective. They would claim obviously that it was objective. Some of it we would agree with, some of it we may not, and that they used it and creative interpretation to get rid of things. That's his claim.
In fact,
I think it's a plausible claim, but a radical one, and one that I think people would not be so comfortable with.
All the things that they're changing or suggesting are changing related to mass murder, genocide,
yes,
and all the rest of it.
Right.
You implied before that you have to be very careful, as though it's like the thin end of the wedge, but it's not really. I mean, these are things that which are qualitative and different. You know,
right.
I'm just about to sort of ban kashrut.
But nowadays, that would be
exactly a perfect example. You know, why wouldn't we just take this to the next step and say, you know what, the Torah didn't really think, they didn't really say you could shecht animals. It was just I don't know, you could shecht animals if it's a Tuesday at 1 o'clock in the morning. You know, you could play games.
But it's not, because they're taking themselves specifically to killing other people.
But who's to say the next person to come along with something they're uncomfortable with won't do the same thing? That's the danger.
But the people in Sanhedrin had Ruach HaKodesh, okay, and had connection to God.
All right, I have a question on Eugene Korn, with all due respect. Why did God say it in the first place?
It was suitable for that. It's a very dangerous.
So what does that mean, it was suitable?
Right.
God said to...
It's very dangerous to say this, but I think I'm going to say it anyway. I think it was suitable at that time. People were more barbaric. People were more used to killing one another. It was more acceptable. And therefore, it was acceptable for this to be a suitable punishment for X. Today, already in their day, it was already considered, the Jews were like way ahead from an ethical and moral point of view.
You know what? Maybe it is worth it to jump around. If you go all the way to the bottom of the page, it says, what do you want from them? Everyone who's doing it. You see where it says that? Oh. Yeah, turn the page over.
Let's get back to it.
Right.
Because that one basically just says,
yeah, yeah. Well, let's get back to it, though, because I just, because what Simon was saying, I think it's important. Rav Kook says as follows, it's on the third page if you're looking. Regarding war, it would have been impossible at a time when all the neighbors were literal wolves of the night that only Israel refrained from war. For then they would have gathered and eradicated them, God forbid. Moreover, it was necessary for them to cast their fear on the barbarians through harsh conduct, albeit with the hope of bringing humanity to the state that it ought to reach, but without prematurely anticipating it. What Rav Kook is saying is that it made sense in the time of the Chumash, and it even made sense in the time of Shaul. Why? Because shock and awe, baby. You gotta go full force. This is the way people are doing war. We have to do it the same way, if for no other reason than to defend ourselves and to make sure that nothing bad happens to us and people take us seriously. So it makes sense to eradicate the entire nation at the time, because if you don't, then you'll look weak. Then people will come after you and they may destroy you. But once that's no longer necessary anymore, then chalila v'chas that we should continue doing it. I could see that being the tip of Eugene Korn's argument. In other words, he would say it made sense at the time to give that mitzvah.
Is he talking about Kenanim, or is he talking about?
He could be talking about everybody.
No, something
in context.
Because specifically as in conquering the Kenanim, as in killing the Kenanim, like when they conquered, especially since the Kenanim were actually given a way out.
Right.
If they became Eric Kanan, like
right, right, of course.
But Amalek is harder to explain within this paragraph that you bring. It's much harder because they weren't necessarily the direct, you know.
Okay, according to the Sefer Chinuch, you're right. There's no holds barred. But I just want to
discussing the principle here. is that principle accepted? Do you accept the fact that the these commandments were suitable at that time, based on also Rav Kook, what Rav Kook's saying, we had to do it then because otherwise we would have been destroyed. Today it's not relevant, therefore we don't need to do it.
Right, so I'm just questioning, is even Rav Kook, does this fit with the mitzvah Amalek? Because Amalek was just, there's one specific mitzvah with Amalek, which we don't have with the other.
I mean, what I think is fascinating over here is that nobody, not Eugene Korn and not Rav Kook, is saying that the mitzvah doesn't exist. They're not saying that. And they're not even saying it doesn't exist today. They're just saying that it cannot be applied today. Eugene Korn says the way that we make sure it doesn't apply today is we darshan it out of existence. And he claims that Chazal do that, I guess you'd say subjectively, of their own initiative, based on their moral intuition, which may be God's intention. Maybe God's intention. And you insert Rav Kook here and say the Chazal were comfortable doing this because they said, you know, it made sense to do it at that time, but now no longer does. So we're going to darshan out of existence, which is not to say it's not one of the 613. It's just to say that we can't do it anymore. Its time has come. Still radical, but we can work with it. And you know, you wouldn't necessarily worry about somebody taking that and, you know, dropping it on every single mitzvah in the Torah.
Rav Kook is not saying it's not applicable.
The Gemara says
not
it's
not. Not in the same way. Rav Kook is just saying it was necessary then, but not today.
Right, so that's how we can justify. Well, he doesn't. It's not applicable today. So all he's interested in is why was it ever applicable? Why did it exist at all?
This in itself is a pretty dangerous statement to make also.
That what?
This mitzvah is not applicable today.
The Gemara says that.
People could say this about, I'm choosing this mitzvah. Don't eat chazer.
No, but nobody says it's not applicable today because it's immoral. Nobody says that. People say it's not applicable today because we don't know who Amalek is.
That's not what Rav Kook says.
But the Gemara says, Rav Kook has to agree with that.
The Gemara is saying
that. Right.
Rav Kook is not ever going to say outright and just say, you know, even if you know who Amalek is, or even if we all know who Amalek is, then you don't have to do it anymore. He wouldn't say that. He's not saying that.
Rav Kook is adding to the Gemara. He's not,
yes.
He's not, okay.
Yes.
So he is saying what your father's saying.
What he's saying is that practically, anyways, it's over. It's not going to happen anymore. Practically. We're bothered philosophically. He's dealing with a philosophical problem.
How about the halachic issue or the hashkafic issue of saying we have the Torah, we have a mitzvah, we've basically deleted it.
Basically.
So yes, that's exactly right. So Rav Kook says the justification for deleting it might be that it's immoral. The mechanism for deleting it, so to speak, would be creative interpretation.
But it's not really deleted because we're talking about a historical context at the beginning. We're talking about where we're at now. But who's to say that it won't become relevant again in the future? It's still there.
That's a very good point.
That's right.
It's a very good point. Because like if we were now at the time of the Second World War and we had the Nazis, I don't think there's any Jew that wouldn't say the Nazis are equivalent to Amalek.
Well, yeah, but then
but they are genetically Amalek.
Yeah, but you wouldn't say.
So we have to hold off on that.
If you had Hitler's son sitting in front of you, would you say that he's genetically evil, or would you say no, he deserves it?
Well, Western would say he's not genetically evil.
You're the one who said you wouldn't do
it. No, I agree. I was asking you.
I wouldn't.
So that's Rav Kook. That's Rav Kook. Now, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, go back a previous page, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, in a very important essay, which wasn't really about this, but it's one of the famous lines from it. So he's talking about just the source of his faith, and really he's talking about his belief in God, Bichlal, and he's trying to figure out where his faith comes from. And one of the things he says is, the source of my support was not confined to my immediate rabbis, in general, he says. At one point during my late teens, I was troubled by certain ethical questions concerning the destruction of Amalek. I then recalled having recently read that Rav Chaim Brisker would awaken nightly to see if someone hadn't placed a foundling at his doorstep. Foundling meaning a baby that was being given away. I knew that apparently this was a common occurrence, by the way. People would leave.
In America?
No, in Brisk.
In Brisk.
People would just leave babies at his doorstep. I knew that I slept quite soundly. And I concluded that if such a paragon of kindness coped with these laws, evidently the source of my anxiety did not lie in my greater sensitivity, but in my weaker faith, and I set myself to enhancing it. In other words, Rav Aaron's answer to this question was, I don't know, but people greater than me aren't bothered by it, and so I'm not going to be bothered by it. That was his answer. Wow. It's an honest answer. It's not a satisfying answer, but it's an honest teens. Answer. What?
It's his answer from his teens.
This is the answer from his teens, and he wrote this years later. Yeah, no, this is an essay that he wrote years later. Look, it's in the same vein. This answer is in the same vein of something that I heard from him. I heard from him personally when he was asked at a gross question and answer. He was asked at a panel about going up to Har HaBayit. And he said, look, I don't know whether you should or you shouldn't. I just know that I won't, because David HaMelech said, "Mi yaleh lahar Hashem, niki kapayim uvar levav." People who have clean hands and pure hearts, and I don't have niki kapayim uvar levav, so I don't think that I can go up. So to me, it was just like,
said that?
100%. I heard him say it. I was there. I didn't record it because it was Shabbos, but
why did he say, like?
Because he thinks that's what he feels. He feels he's not ra'oi to go up to Har HaBayit.
Or he wanted to.
I don't think he obfuscates Varon. I think he says what he means, personally.
Wasn't the whole point of Har HaBayit to go up there if you weren't Niki Kapayim, so that you could become Niki Kapayim? That's the whole point.
That's what he said.
If you have to bring, if you're bringing a Korban, but you're not bringing a Korban now.
Right.
Okay, so you go up and down. I mean, I have done it, but I'm just saying. Well, but David HaMelech says it, right? David HaMelech does say it. Mi yaleh lahar Hashem, niki kapayim uvar levav. Asher lo nasa lashav nafshi. David HaMelech said it. He doesn't say go up to become niki kapayim uvar levav. He says you have to be niki kapayim uvar levav. Just saying. It's just what he says.
He's not a lady.
That's it. That was his answer, and I just thought it was strikingly similar to this. In other words, in terms of its humility, and at the same time, the way that it makes you feel like an ant.
I prefer the Zilbert.
So that's Rav Aaron. So Rav Aaron just says, I shrug my shoulders. Rav Eliyahu Henkin, this is one of the Gedolim of America. Dad, he lived in the same time as Rav Moshe, I believe. If this is the same Rav Eliyahu Henkin, who was the father, I always get confused, father, grandfather, I think, of Rav Yosef Henkin, who lives in Yerushalayim, whose wife is the founder of Nishmat, and whose son was Rav Eintam Henkin, who died a few years ago. So he, the grandfather, I think it's a grandfather, so he wrote, this just astonishing, he says, to prevent the stories in the Bible from influencing our nature and spirit, the study of Bible comes with a sacred melody, and matters are stated as if in a different world. The nations we were commanded to make war against, according to Chazal, have become mingled with others and no longer exist. One cannot make inferences to others, for there is no commandment and no prophet. We'll get to why he says that in a second, but what I thought is astonishing is, he's not talking about the mitzvah per se, he's really more talking about the stories. Right, he's more talking about the stories outside of the mitzvah of Amalek. Just the way that we see that Bnei Yisrael were asked to conduct war is in a very you know, there are no innocent civilians. There are no there's no hold barred, no holds barred whatsoever. You don't knock on the roof before you drop the bomb. There's none of that. And so he says, you know, how do we read these stories? He says an amazing thing. He says basically you have to detach yourself. Don't read Tanakh in a way that you're relating to it. It almost sounds like he's saying you have to kind of see it as stories that you learn lessons from, but not, I don't know, more like fables that you learn lessons from, but not stories that you really get into the kishkas and like, and take every single...
I think isn't he saying just to detach from the specific details of it, but you've got to learn the important lesson from it?
He says don't put yourself in the context.
Imagine if we had a Torah which didn't have any concept anywhere of revenge. What would that make us as a people, navigating the world over the last few thousand years? Seriously, yeah. I mean, that's also not Jewish. We say it's not Jewish to take revenge. But imagine if the whole concept of revenge, there was nothing anywhere remotely similar to Amalek. It would make us something different as well, you know. Having a bit of revenge,
right, but
as a concept.
But this is he's not talking about. He's not even talking about Amalek. He's talking about the stories.
Is Amalek based on revenge?
Well, it's because it's about, you know, because of what they did to you.
No, there is that. It's what it says.
Is it because of what they did or because of what they represent?
I don't know. Based on what the Torah says, it's because of what they did. Based on what the Torah says. We can
it's
get deep into the machshava.
Somebody new who's been born, and
they come from them.
It's because of what they represent.
You're right, and that's a very modern take on, you know, race relations and international relations.
Okay.
But you can imagine, you know, the Capulets and the Montagues, right? You can imagine two families that are feuding. It does not matter how it started. It does not matter how long ago it happened.
Okay.
You come from there and I come from here. That is the way that the world worked for many, many millennia. It doesn't work that, you know, it still works that way in some places, but in Western countries, it doesn't work that way. Although, you know, to some degree, you know, the way that black people look at white people in America, you know, I will be forever a slave trader, right? In certain ways. For some people, not for everybody.
Well, the way white people look at black people in America.
Yeah.
I'll ask a seasonal question. Why didn't Mordechai kill Haman?
If Haman was, I don't know if that was an option. I don't know if that was an option. It's a good question.
Sure, I don't know. Mordechai read the Gemara Brachos. It was they're already rich in it. They're already Gemara Brachos.
His name was Haman Hagagi. If we really think that he was Amalek physically, then it's hard to imagine Mordechai didn't know that. I don't know. Maybe he didn't have that as an option. Another, if you go to the next slide.
You can answer Matthew's question about revenge.
I don't know. Look, we can go deeper and say there's something deeply wrong with Amalek. But on the surface level, the Torah just says, remember what they did to you? You can never forgive it. That's what the Torah says. You can go deeper, but that's just the surface level of what it says. And not only does it say in the Torah, it's what Shaul gets told. Right?
Does he get? Do I remember that Shaul left somebody alive and got punished for it?
Yeah, Agag. Agag. Right. The king. And the animals. And the
some of the
animals for Korbanos, yeah.
So what did Amalek actually do that was qualitatively different to any other people?
They came from across the world to attack us as we were leaving Egypt for no reason. We weren't going into their territory. We were nowhere near them. We weren't even going towards their territory. Came from nowhere to attack a people that just escaped from slavery. Why?
Do they have their own philosophy that is like completely like the anti-Yiddishkeit?
I mean, that's definitely the Hasidic and classic.
Where is that?
Because Amalek was in the north. They were north of Israel.
What was the Hashkafah? What was their derech? Apart from attacking women and children,
they came across.
What was so bad about them?
Well,
what was so bad about Amalek? What did they? I don't.
Attacked our weakest.
They came from across the world.
Okay, right.
For no reason. And they attacked Kol Anechal Shalim Acharecha. They attacked us when we were weak.
According to one of the scriptures we had here recently.
Good tactics.
This was.
But for what? For what reason?
This was what I'm. According to one of the speakers
we had recently.
According to one of the speakers we had recently, this is what Amalek did for a living. They attacked.
Right.
They were a band of pirates who would attack the weak,
right,
and steal their money, right, and steal their people and sell them into slavery.
Right.
And this is how they made their living.
Right. Yeah.
Also, there's another reason. It wasn't a pointless attack.
According to that, it's not just that they attacked the Jews because they hated Jews.
Fine.
Where did you get that from?
So do you want those? You want people like that sticking around?
Yeah, but there's lots of people like that. I mean, that's the thing.
We should get rid of them.
That's particularly unusual behavior.
We should get rid of them. If a country attacks us because they're worried we're going to attack them. All right, Seder. But if a country attacks us...
Do you know where your father... from what your father just said is from?
One of the speakers recently said...
I've heard that before.
You've heard that?
Most of the stuff I'm getting, by the way, is from... some of the stuff I'm getting is from an article by Rav Helfgott. Nati Helfgott. He has a book.
Is Helfgott the Chazan?
No.
I
don't think so. What? Right,
that sort of thing goes on today.
What? Yeah.
People attack other. I mean, you know, why are the Iranians attacking us? We don't have any border dispute, right, or land dispute or.
Well, that I see as a little bit different. It could be religiously motivated.
We have nuclear.
And all right, you know.
Which is Jewish?
Pirates. They're pirates. If you have pirates, like what my dad is describing, look, you know. Alpi machshava and alpi chasidut, it's much deeper than that. It's a religious war. Amalek is, you know, cannot stand the idea of God, mm-hmm, and cannot stand people, you know, performing mitzvot. And so it's more about that. But, you know, you don't find that in the text. My Rebbe, Rabbi Shalom Karmi, so in an article in Tradition, so he wrote further to Rav Kook. He quotes Rav Yoel Ben Nun. Rav Ben Nun, in effect, taking up Rav Kook's remarks, believes that the Jewish mentality is deeply averse to war. For that reason, it was necessary for God to, which, you know, that's hard to take when you actually look at Tanakh. to say that the Torah is averse to, Alpi Pshat, that's very hard to accept, that the Torah is averse to war. For that reason, it was necessary for God to command the prosecution of the conquest with ferocity. Look what he just did. That's amazing, that pivot that he just did. Allowing any room for mercy would risk a collective loss of nerve. An amazing thing that he just quoted Rabbi Nun as saying. Basically, he said, because the Jewish mentality is deeply averse to war, God had to give such ferocious directives to make sure that we prosecuted the war to the fullest effect. Anybody ever read Ender's Game? No?
That's that was the point I was trying to say before, that it, even if it's not specific to those facts of Amalek, and Amalek don't exist now, we don't know who they are, that if there are times when we have to go to war, a justified war, there's messages in the Torah about, you know, you have to follow it through, you have to be ferocious.
100%.
There are important lessons there about, and the concept, whether it's the concept of revenge or the manner of war.
This is how you teach your children that you have to finish what you started.
I think there's something very important.
Finish what you started.
We don't just throw away all those.
I understand.
Because we say we don't know who.
I mentioned Ender's Game. There's a book called Ender's Game. It's a whole series of books by an author called Orson Scott Card. It's science fiction, It takes place with aliens and everything. But the idea of the book is that there's this boy named Ender, who is the smartest person on Earth, and he's a scrawny boy. But when he gets bullied by another kid, basically he just absolutely goes off on this kid who's trying to bully him. He breaks his nose and just totally destroys the boy. And when they ask him afterwards, you know, how could you do that? He said, look, if I don't go all the way, then first of all, he may win. Or if he doesn't win, he'll try it again. Or somebody else will try it again. It's actually more merciful for me, or at least it's more logical for me, to go all the way right now, take care of it, nip it in the bud completely, as even though it's against my nature, I'm not an aggressive person, to just take care of it right now so it never happens again. Not by him and not by anybody else. That was his position. He does it throughout the book. Like, there are other instances where that happens. I won't spoil any of the book. This line reminds me of it, because you take a person who might be peace loving, and then for some reason he acts, you know, Pinchas, by the way, and he, not Melchior, Pinchas the Kohen, and he acts in a way that is totally ferocious because it's the best way of solving the problem.
Some in today's government think like that as well.
Yeah, I think so. You know what? It's late. Why don't we pick up the rest next time? There's a lot more good. There's more good stuff in this, and then we have to flip the table when we get to the Rambam.
The Rambam says what?
I'm not telling you.
Don't
you have the Rambam.